Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. One of the enduring questions surrounding the Tulsa race massacre has been in relation to estimating the long-term impact of the lost earnings and wealth from the looting and burning of the Greenwood community on both survivors and their descendants. This is especially important when considering reparations. No insurance proceeds benefited those Tulsans who lost both possessions and property. If they stayed, they rebuilt from their own funds and labor. And if they migrated, they did so with no tangible assets from their time in Tulsa. Using recently released digitized census data, two economists from Wheaton College in Illinois have been examining the long-term impact on earnings and wealth in the Greenwood community from 1920, 1 year before the violence, through 1940, nearly 20 years later. They found that compared to segregated black communities and surrounding cities, Tulsa's community fared poorly, with a significant disparity between the city's white community by comparison. Jason Long is a Bennett Professor of Economics and an economic historian at Wheaton College. His co-author, Jeremy Cook, is a labor economist at Wheaton. They wrote an article as a part of the Atlantic's Inheritance Project about American history and black life. They're co-authors of the New Atlantic article, How 24 Hours of Racial Violence Caused Decades of Harm. And they're my guests today on Studio Tulsa. Professor Long, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
One of the complex questions surrounding the Tulsa race massacre has been what has been the long-term impact on black Tulsans' earnings after the destruction in Greenwood. You and your colleague have tried to measure that. How did you go about trying to find an answer for that?
So we have lots of interesting hints on that from well-known stories that locals recorded, that historians have recorded. But to get a sense for how earnings were affected for black Tulsans kind of as a whole after the massacre, we're really relying on census data, which is unique, essentially, and including everyone. The census doesn't have a ton of information about every person, but it makes up for that by at least trying to ask everyone, you know, some basic information about them, including their occupation. And from occupation, we can deduce earnings. So that's really a key record for us. We get it every 10 years. So we have a census record in 1920, right before the massacre. And we have censuses after that. Now, they don't go public until 72 years after the enumeration to protect privacy. So that means we also have censuses for 1930 and for 1940. And that really represents kind of the key data we use to try to get at that question.
Well, your analysis points to a loss in earnings from 1920 to 1930, then again from 1930 to 1940. Some of that you might expect with the Great Depression, but you contrast that to other African-American communities and cities around the region, and what happened to Tulsa in those 20 years does stand out, right?
Yeah, it really does. I mean, of course, one of the challenges always with doing this kind of history, really this kind of economics, is, you know, we don't have a laboratory. We can't precisely control for the effect of the massacre of any one event, like a chemist could precisely control for an effect in their lab. So we do sort of the best we can. Exactly as you say, we kind of look at other cities that were somewhat similar to Tulsa, cities like Oklahoma City and Wichita and Little Rock, that were sort of geographically similar and kind of had similar sort of population. And in a way, they're sort of our control group, right? They were similar in a lot of ways, but they didn't have this massacre. And it's very striking when you do that comparison to see how in 1920, the sort of economic situation of black residents of Tulsa is sort of comfortably ahead of that group of cities, and after that, in 1930 and again in 1940, it really falls behind. And we can sort of have a little bit even more confidence that we're hopefully looking at the effect of the massacre by doing the same analysis for white residents, and we don't see the same pattern. So we see earnings for white residents of Tulsa really just track those other cities. It sort of starts ahead, it stays ahead. There doesn't seem to be any different effect. So it's at least, you know, strongly consistent with the idea that the massacre lowered the earnings of black Tulsans, you know, to a point below where they should have been or would have been in the absence of the massacre.
Now, one of the things to point out about the Greenwood District was you had this concentration of black-owned businesses at that time. Does the census data point that out from 1910 to 1920?
Yeah. I mean, it does. We can, you know, we can really drill down right into the to the city, even into the neighborhood, and see, you know, see these records of individuals and see, you know, black-owned shops and black-owned boarding houses and hotels and things like that, as you say, particularly in the Greenwood neighborhood.
Now, when you dig down in the census records and compare individual Greenwood residents that stayed after the violence with those that left, you also found striking stories as well.
Yeah, that to us was really one of the most interesting questions. I've spent a lot of my academic career studying migration and, you know, people's decisions of when to go to a place, when to stay to a place, when to leave a place. And I think really one of the most interesting results we found, to me anyway, is kind of comparing the folks that decided to stay and the folks that decided to leave. And I should add that this is not something that historians or economic historians have been able to do for very long. This really requires not just census data, but the census data to be digitized and searchable so that we can track people across censuses, even if they decide to change where they live, which, of course, in America, particularly, you know, historically, was quite common. We're a country of people that particularly in the past, like to move around a lot. So we highlight in our research, you know, sort of mini stories of individuals that didn't necessarily leave a strong trace in the record. I mean, we know well-known people like, for example, Ottawa and Emma Gurley owned a Gurley Hotel. You know, there's a street in Greenwood named after them. But, for example, we found records on a man named Gibson Van Dyke and contrast him with another man named Roy Drew. Both were in Tulsa in 1920. Gibson Van Dyke managed a rooming house. They were actually on Archer Street, the sort of commercial center of Greenwood, that was heavily damaged in the burning. They stayed in Tulsa, and we can find Gibson in the census 10 years later and no longer managing a rooming house. He was a low-wage, unskilled worker in the construction industry. And we contrast him to Roy Drew, who was a worker, just an employee in a drugstore in Tulsa in 1920. We can find him in 1930 having relocated to Kansas City, Kansas, where he owned and operated a pharmacy. And those are stories. Those are, I think, compelling stories. What we can do with the data show that it does represent something that was sort of broadly true. You know, one thing that we think was really sort of striking after the massacre was it looked like now the Van Dykes and Drews don't fit this perfectly, but it looked like on average, higher earners were more likely to move away from Tulsa than were people in occupations that paid less after the massacre. And that we think that could be part of what was driving these effects in the longer term.
Well, you look at somebody like Gibson Van Dyke, he is managing. He's like maybe a low level, but a mid-level manager. A decade later, he's working as, you know, low-end unskilled labor. Yet a guy who's on the low end of the scale in, you know, Roy Drew, working as, you know, just an employee in the drugstore, he's actually owning his own pharmacy. That makes I mean, that is one isolated story. But it sounds like this was something you saw repeated more than once.
It was, yeah. And you know, we like the stories. The stories, I think, are evocative and important. It sort of helps, I think, the reader connect with data in a way that can be harder, you know, if you're not an empirical social scientist like we are and, you know, love just getting hands dirty with data. But yeah, really the key results are those sort of statistical results that come from the data. And we really think of statistics as just a way to tell the story of all the stories, right? It's a way to to say this was an overall trend. Of course, in our academic work, we rely heavily on the kind of statistical analysis that gives us, you know, hard sort of quantitative measures to go along with the anecdotes, which I think are themselves compelling.
Now, one of the interesting things about census data is that I guess they ask different questions over a course of decades. Were there any limitations to the census data of this period for making this sort of detailed analysis of how earnings were affected? And really a larger question is how wealth was affected over a course of a couple of 20 years after the race massacre?
Yeah, Rich, that's a great question. You know, like I said, the census is brilliant in its coverage. You know, it gets everybody, or again, in theory, gets everybody. But it's sparse, you know. The census is as you know, I'm sure it's political. It's a counting device. You know, the idea is to count people for political purposes. And so the census typically would always rather ask fewer questions and get more responses than ask a lot of questions and potentially get people not responding. So you bring up a great one in earnings. You know, we would love it if the census enumerators of 1920 and 1930 had asked everyone detailed questions about their job, their earnings, their hours worked, those sorts of things. They didn't. They really just asked them what their occupation was, in which industry they worked, and whether they were a wage worker or an employer. So what economic historians typically do, of course, we have to deal with the data that history leaves us. You know, we don't get to rewrite the survey and go ask the questions we really would love to ask. We have to make do with what we have. My advisor in graduate school called us sort of the paleontologists, you know, of the economics world. We're sort of digging around for bones, right? And the data are the bones, and they're never quite complete, and you always have to sort of piece them together, you know, to the best of your ability. So, yeah. For example, we can do things like impute someone's earnings. We can say this is what, for example, a carpenter, you know, would have usually made, and we can consider that to be kind of an average earnings, or an unskilled laborer in construction, or a manager of a rooming house. So, you know, those are the kind of limitations we have, and those are the kind of strategies we use to deal with those limitations.
They also ask a lot more questions. Certainly today they ask a lot of socioeconomic questions. Were they asking those sorts of questions in 1920, 30, and 40? Because one of the things you do find out is that the effect on Black Tulsans was more than just wages. It had other impacts as well, like, for example, being married.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, again, the census is like it's very concerned with households. So we have a lot of information that has to do with family structure. We know if people were married. We know how many children they had, at least living in the house. We know things like whether they owned or rented their home. And so we use that information to round out the picture on earnings. As you say, we see pretty, you know, broad and profound effects in Tulsa. It wasn't just earnings that had this sort of negative effect for Black people in Tulsa relative to the comparison cities. We see them lose ground in home ownership. We see them lose ground in their employment rates. And we see them have a lower marriage rate than we estimate they would have had in the absence of the massacre. So, you know, the census doesn't tell us maybe a ton of things, but in the dimensions that it reveals, we see quite a bit of evidence of a persistent negative impact of this event for Black folks in Tulsa.
My guest today is Jason Long. He's an economic historian at Wheaton College. He's the Bennett Professor of Economics there. He and his colleague, Jeremy Cook, who is a labor economist, have written an article for The Atlantic. It's part of their Inheritance Project about American history and Black life. And they're co-author of a new article titled, How 24 Hours of Racial Violence Caused Decades of Harm. Now, can you get at the bigger question of not just earnings, but wealth? Is that are you able to extrapolate anything from the census data, or is it just too limited in its information it collected to answer questions about wealth and wealth building?
Yeah, it's a great question. You hit the nail on the head earlier when you say they don't ask quite the same questions in every census. And there are censuses where they ask some questions about wealth, about real estate wealth, but none of our censuses, unfortunately, ask direct wealth questions. So the first answer to your question is we can't say anything directly about wealth, and that's an important one for obvious reasons, with respect to the conversation around this event. Now, you can start to quantify things like that with our results, but you're still not quite there. I mean, earnings, of course, matter for wealth. Home ownership matters for wealth. But yeah, it's another one of those instances where, boy, you wish those enumerators had asked that that wealth question, and for whatever reason they didn't in those years. So, like I said, we view this as sort of a nice piece in that direction, but you need to do a lot more work, I think, to get something very precise with respect to wealth.
But again, by 1940, you're seeing Black Tulsans, their average earnings are going down, their employment is going down. Now, you can also say, well, there was a depression for 10 years from 30 to 40. But how does that compare to white citizens in Tulsa and to other African-American citizens in those comparison cities, Oklahoma City, Wichita, and Little Rock? Were they seeing declines as well, or were they seeing small, maybe very small increases over that same time period?
Yeah. So, as best we could tell with our data, this is where our kind of comparative framework really is necessary. So as you're looking at say, white earning in Tulsa and the comparison cities, we see it going down. And I should say like I said, this is sort of occupational earnings. This is earnings associated with occupation. We see that going down in the 30s, as you would expect, in the Great Depression. We see the earnings of Black Tulsans going down. And what's sort of interesting is we don't really see that decline for Black residents of the control cities or the comparison cities, Oklahoma City, Wichita, Little Rock, et cetera. Those really weren't the focus of our study, so I'm not prepared to necessarily say what was going on there, but that helps us to sort of identify the effect on Blacks in Tulsa specifically, right? That there was no, for whites, there didn't seem to be a differential effect in Tulsa relative to the other cities we're looking at. And for Blacks in Tulsa, there really was a differential effect even during the Depression from 1930 to 1940.
You also looked at, as you mentioned earlier, you compared people who moved and who stayed. And when you look over maybe a generation or so, and we're looking at multi-generational issues, that just sort of amplifies greatly. At one point, you write, have a statistic that says leaving increased average Black earnings by 88%. That's a big number.
That's a huge number, yeah. That's a bigger number than you often see for things like this. Again, this is relatively new stuff that we're able to do by tracking people across censuses. In this case, we track sons, essentially youngsters in 1920 living with their families. So we can, because the census records households, we see that son maybe as an 8-year-old, and we see his father and mother in the same household, in the same census. So we get a sense of their sort of economic situation from the occupation of the father, perhaps the mother as well. We track that son into a census 20 years later, so 1940. Now we see a 28-year-old. And the beauty of these digitized sort of big data census records is that researchers can search for an individual guy. We highlight Clarence Holman, as a son who left Tulsa between 1920 and 1940 and prospered. And we can find Clarence. You can't always find him, but often you can track these individuals down, even if they leave. So Clarence Holman ends up in Nashville, Tennessee. His father had been a porter, which is a relatively low-paying occupation. Clarence is an insurance agent in Nashville, Tennessee. So we contrast him with another son, an 8-year-old in 1920, Ralph Knight, who remained behind in Tulsa. We find him as an 8-year-old in Tulsa in 1920. We see him as a 28-year-old in 1940. He had been the son of a tailor, solid occupation in Greenwood, and at age 28, he's a bellman at a local hotel. And again, that's one story, but what our overall data analysis reveal is that was not an unusual outcome, that the sons who left, we see, do much better than the sons who remain behind, which, again, adds to just the profound impact, right, that it could be not just over time, but across generations.
And what's also interesting is you sort of take a snapshot of where the Greenwood District was in 1920, before 1921, and you saw that, the rate of young people getting their education was higher than comparison cities. Does that all evaporate 20 years later? Advantages from the community that was there in 20, has that some of those advantages evaporated 20 years later?
Certainly some of those advantages have evaporated. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say we've shown that every advantage evaporates. I think, for us, really the emphasis was on earnings. We're economists, so maybe we focus on earnings almost too much. But it's almost always sort of that first order, consideration for economists. Like we talked about before, we're able to see, some other ways in which it looks like Tulsa falls behind, like the home ownership and like the marriage rate. But no, I wouldn't say we've necessarily shown that every advantage was lost. And of course, this is maybe a stock answer for an academic, but we always leave openings for more research, right? There's always every research project leads to the next research project. We'd hate to work ourselves out of a job.
Yeah. Now, one of the one of the great beliefs, and it's pretty well factual as far as seeing what happened to the Greenwood District after the massacre, was the community came in, rebuilt, and the story was it was bigger and more vibrant and more prosperous 10, 15, 20 years after the race massacre than it was before. Is there any way to test that statement, and did you get into that statement?
Well, I think this really gets to the crux of the issue for an economist, particularly for an economic historian like myself, is that really in a way both can be true. Your eyes can tell you that a town or a neighborhood was rebuilt. We don't doubt those accounts and that history. Individual stories can lead you in interesting directions. Kind of observation like that is important. But we think it's only with this kind of nitty-gritty data that you could tease out these sort of subtle effects. Like, it's very possible, in fact, I would say, given what we know, probable, that it was largely rebuilt, but that masked an underlying reality, which is that it wasn't where it should have been. It wasn't where it would have been in the absence of a massacre. But it takes, I think, a kind of subtle and careful look at data to identify something like, yeah, you can see that these buildings are rebuilt, but it's not easy to see with the eye or with a few stories that families aren't prospering quite as much as they should be or as they would have been without the massacre. We think that's that's really important. It's subtle. It's not necessarily easy to know. And it's why, sort of the stock and trade of what we do is dig into that data and look for that sort of those sort of subtle effects.
We do know that it was rebuilt, but we also know that the losses were never recompensated.
Yeah.
There was no insurance proceeds from the business owners that were burned out. So they expended capital they already had to get to a place of restarting where they were before. The loss of property and loss of income and earnings from, this disruption through violence.
Yeah, and we think, our results underscore just how harmful that would be. I mean, if you imagine a situation where there are no insurance claims, where people, maybe they have built up some savings because of the prosperity of Greenwood, because Tulsa was a boom town, and because there was a sort of, you know, I don't want to say unique, but pretty rare sort of flourishing of a vibrant Black middle class in Tulsa. Maybe they had, you know, more savings and some ability to rebuild. But as you say, that savings takes a hit if there is no, you know, for example, insurance to pick up the to make good the loss. And then if you imagine earnings being depressed and occupational prospects being depressed 10 and 20 years after the fact, I think that only compounds, you know, the damage done by that wealth loss.
My guest today is Jason Long. He's an economic historian at Wheaton College. He and his colleague Jeremy Cook, a labor economist at Wheaton, have written an article for The Atlantic, part of their Inheritance series, titled How 24 Hours of Racial Violence Caused Decades of Harm, looking at census data of the Greenwood area and the people that lived in Greenwood in 1920, where they migrated to. And of course, the one question, you know, that is, continues on about the massacre is in the context of reparations, you know, long-term repayment of some of that loss. What does this analysis mean? Does it seem to indicate that there was a loss of wealth during the massacre that was ongoing and multi-generational?
You know, it's such an important question. It's such a weighty question. It's a vital question to think through. You know, I don't want to claim too much for our contribution to it here. I think some of the things we've talked about, you know, really getting a handle on wealth impacts, for example, would be crucial. But I would say I think it's an important piece. I think one of the big questions with respect to reparations is sort of what magnitude is sensible. There are other questions like what magnitudes are politically feasible, but economic questions around what numbers, you know, sort of make sense. And I think getting some handle on depression of earnings, on potential multi-generation impacts, I think are an important piece of, admittedly, a very complex calculation.
The name of the article is How 24 Hours of Racial Violence Caused Decades of Harm. It's in the Atlantic, part of their Inheritance series. And Jason, thanks very much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
Jason Long is an economic historian, the Bennett Professor of Economics at Wheaton College. He and his co-author, Jeremy Cook, a labor economist at Wheaton College, are the author of How 24 Hours of Racist Violence Caused Decades of Harm, published in The Atlantic, part of The Atlantic's Inheritance Project about American history and Black life. You can read the article at theatlantic.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.